Not long until the start of the F1 season, so let's take you behind testing. Let's find out what the big stories are, what they'll be this season. This is your Fast Talkers podcast. If you like what you hear, don't forget, subscribe. That's always nice, and it makes sure this pops into your inbox as soon as it's published. Thanks again, and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Fast Talkers as we prepare for the brand new Formula One season. Yes, we are so close that testing has happened. All 3 days of it, the drama, the intrigue, the questions it has raised. And we are going to have a good old natter about it with some of the best people from the paddock that I could pick for you. So without further ado, let me introduce you to them. And we will start with Tobias Gruner, all the way from Germany. Tobias is the Amos journalist. He is the man who I suppose a lot of people look to in the paddock for technical news. Toby, thank you so much for coming along. How good, bad or ugly was testing for you personally?
It was very ugly, I have to say. I had to stay at home in my office for the first time since, I don't know, like since 13 years, you know. I have been testing all my life, in every season, especially winter testing was always very important for us, you know, the most important weeks of the year. We got the most traffic during testing, and yeah, the most exciting weeks from my point of view. So yeah, not the best days behind me, I have to say.
Oh, well, the season is going to start very soon, and hopefully that means we will all get to a racetrack at some point. That's what I'm crossing my fingers for. Let's go to Tom Bellingham next. Tom is WTF1 founder. He's got a guitar right behind his head and a very cool chair as well, which puts my boring office chair to shame. Tom, lovely to see you. I'm guessing you were not at testing.
I was not, no. Classic armchair enthusiast.
You're allowed to be, and especially show us your armchair because it's a cool one. Look at that.
There we go.
Very cool. Ladies. We will talk about testing in just a moment, but we also want to talk about a little bit and pay our respects to the wonderful, legendary Murray Walker. Of course, his passing announced this week, and I think everybody in Britain, and Toby, you'll have to excuse us for a moment talking about this because we can't help ourselves, because Murray Walker was just part of motorsport so fundamentally. And Tom, you've got a couple of stories you could share with us.
Yeah, so I, like I'm sure many people in the UK, grew up listening to Murray Walker, and I'm sure a lot of people were the same, that I genuinely don't think that I would have loved Formula One as much without him, because he just captured it immediately, especially when I got into Formula One when I was maybe 8 or 9, having this guy shouting at you at every moment. You know, he could make a boring overtake by Pedro Diniz for 17th sound like it was the world championship overtaking maneuver. Like, he was that enthusiastic about everything. And I was very lucky to meet him as a fan twice. One when I was a kid and we saw him at Silverstone, and my dad shouted across the paddock and he actually came over and chatted to us about Formula One for ages. And yeah, genuinely, like, lovely guy. And then met him maybe 10 years ago when I was a bit older, and a very similar experience where all he wanted to do is just chat to you about F1. It was like chatting to a family member that just loved Formula One. And I think it sounds like a lot of people had very similar experiences, that he had so much time for everyone and just loved the sport.
I bore everybody by the fact that the first time I went to his house to interview him, he knew my name. And I was just like, hang on a minute. Murray Walker just called me Jenny Gow, and he knows who I am and everything. And it was like one of those fundamental moments of your career when you just go, I don't really need anything else. I could sign out now and just be very happy. Sam Collins, F1 technical analyst, also joined us. If you haven't guessed yet, we're going to talk technical stuff. But Sam, a few words from you, if you wouldn't mind, about the wonderful Murray Walker.
I was thinking, just back to sitting on a sofa in my bedroom in my parents' house at, must have been 4 or 5 in the morning, watching the Japanese Grand Prix on BBC television and struggling to stay awake in the sort of preamble. And then you hear the lights go out and go, go, go. And then you're wide awake all the way through the whole race. And he just, even though it wasn't the greatest race, the one I'm thinking of. He just made everything exciting. And, you know, we were in the press room, it wasn't the official one. We had a little sort of commentator's press room at the race circuit at the weekend. And obviously when we got that really sad news come through, we all just sort of sat down as a group of people who'd been commentating on Formula One. And all of us just looked back to him as this guy is still and always will be the voice of Formula One.
Yeah, we're all in his shadow and forever will be. One of my favourite quotes while I was looking through at the weekend was actually that from broadcaster and writer Clive James, who said, and I quote, in the quieter moments, he sounds like his trousers are on fire. And I thought that summed it up beautifully. So from all of us and everyone involved in motorsport, we pay our greatest respects to Murray Walker. And we're all thinking of his family at this moment in time. But let's move on, because he'd like us to talk about the love of his life, the other love of his life from his family, and that is Formula One. So guys, let's get stuck into testing. Toby, let's come to you. Out of all of the cars that you saw, what got you most excited?
Oh, that's a difficult one.
Easy questions on this show, yeah, Toby. No, what's the point in that?
My expectations were very low, you know, before testing or before the launch season at all, you know, with all the restrictions in terms of car development. And to be honest, we saw more interesting stuff than I expected during the first testing week or even on the launch models. We all were very, very excited to see how engineers cope with the new regulations in terms of floor restrictions. And that's probably the thing we were looking at first. But then we saw the McLaren diffuser, which was a very, very individual design solution that nobody else has. And yeah, those are the things we are living for, you know, as journalists, as technical fan, Formula One fans, you know. And yeah. This is just the stuff we love, you know.
Sam, did it get your juices flowing?
I absolutely did. I mean, I'm still going through my notes from yesterday, actually. Today was the first time I had the time to sit down and look at pictures of the Williams, for example. And that's just, what really surprised me. It's like Toby said, we sort of didn't expect a huge amount of interesting and exciting stuff this year. Everybody's looking towards 2022, we thought. And then most of the teams, aside from Haas, turned up with loads of new bits and exciting bits on the car. I mean, Alpine with a three-year-old chassis, that car is almost completely different. Toro Rosso, AlphaTauri have pushed those regulations to beyond the limit. And for me, that's got to be the highlight, because he already said the McLaren diffuser. So I'm going to go with the AlphaTauri front suspension and how they've managed to sort of circumnavigate the token system in a rather cunning and I think possibly slightly controversial way.
And teams have already brought the first upgrades, you know, to testing, and we are in the first budget cap season, you know, so this was totally unexpected, I would say. So we can still hope to see a little bit of development this year, I think. So it's not all lost.
Yeah, I mean, just to jump in, sorry Tom, but just to jump in on that, Toby's absolutely right. On the second day of testing, I thought I'd finished all my work on the Alpine. They bought almost a completely new bodywork set for that car and just changed everything pretty much. And then I had to go and start everything over again. And our guys at Biggin Hill are just frantically, I think even as we speak, sort of trying to put the graphics onto the bodywork packages for our next show that's coming up in a few days' time. And it's going to be, we failed to get everything done by the end of the test. 3 days of testing just isn't enough. Please can we go back to 3 weeks of testing? I think Toby would agree with that. Not just for the bars and the food afterwards.
Just don't get to racing just to do the testing, huh?
Yes, please.
we never get to go racing. That would be a long season, I feel. People like you would love that. Tom, please tell me you would not appreciate a season of all testing, no racing.
I was thinking that. I mean, I'm definitely of the opposite opinion, but I guess that's good. You know, we like a bit of a back and forth. Testing's one of those things that, you know, I feel like is a great hype builder for the start of the season. And I personally loved it being condensed into those 3 days where there was, felt like a lot was going on. You could just sit and watch it all day for 3 days. Like these guys are saying, there was a surprising amount of stuff for what a lot of people kind of assumed it was just a carry-on year, especially, you know, with a lot of teams releasing cars where they put a B at the end, suggesting that it's a carry-on car rather than something completely new. And yeah, the fact that it was condensed into those days, it was a really nice hype builder, I guess. And the fact that when it got to the end of that test and you still had Lewis Hamilton spinning, trying to start a hot lap, it was like, okay, I think that's got a lot of people a lot more, you know, excited for the season. It couldn't have almost happened at a better time as a kind of, oh wow, this is still going on, and the next time they're on track is for you know, the race weekend. So yeah, very exciting.
I think the hype train has definitely left the platform and is fully loaded with people. What I found really interesting is, as you say, with only 3 days of testing, it's left these teams so underprepared. That's what it feels like. Sam, is that justifiable for me to think that?
Well, some teams have managed to get a day or two sneaky extra testing. Aston Martin had 2 days of running. I understand after they had a little bit of an issue at Silverstone in their first test, a little spy on the wall at the racetrack there suggested there might have been some bits of green carbon fibre littering the track a while earlier, but also in their first run. But then they did an extra day at Bahrain just before the main test. So they've had 2 days of running. But crucially, Mercedes are doing their test run tomorrow from when we film this. And it's very interesting to see if they're going to get that problem sorted. I was talking to Andrew Shovlin, and he says it's an aero problem, and that's not a quick fix to get that handling imbalance on that car sorted. So I think the teams are underprepared in some cases, and they haven't managed to work it out. And Mercedes now has just 20 laps of the Bahrain circuit before free practice one that it can get the problems with that car sorted.
Okay, that leads us nicely into the question. How big a pile of poop do Mercedes currently find themselves in? Toby, what's the answer?
Yeah, we ask Mercedes engineers about their mood they're in right now, and it doesn't look good. And I don't think they're only sandbagging, you know. They're really puzzled about this issue they have with the rear instability. And I really do believe that they are. And they say it's even worse than with 2 years ago when they also looked very weak at the end of testing, but then managed to turn it around. But we all know that Mercedes is a problem-solving machine, you know, and they put everything on this issue. And I would be surprised if we wouldn't see, you know, them back to near normal in 2 weeks' time. But I have to say, Red Bull looked pretty impressive, and it wouldn't be a surprise to see them come up with the first win this year as well. So, yeah. It's anyone's guess, you know. It was the most unpredictable testing we had in years, you know, with only 3 days with so different conditions. The track was in from the heat in the morning, the lower temperatures in the evening, the changing winds, the conditions. It's really hard to put it on paper to know what's going on.
Sam, can you explain for people at home what the regulation changes that could have left Mercedes being a little unstuck at the moment?
Yeah, so what's happened is it's all about the aerodynamics at the rear of the car. Formula One and the FIA decided that the F1 cars were getting a little bit too quick for the tracks. And because the 2022 regulations were delayed, of course, by a year, the cars would have got a hell of a lot quicker this year had they done nothing. We were already seeing those tyre failures at Silverstone. So they had to step in to slow those cars down. So they've cut back the rear floor slightly, so these little triangle cutouts at the back. And then, in theory, they should have been these flat plate floors with no sticky uppy bits or flick-ups or any sorts of slots or slashes or complicated aerodynamic bits. But I think the rule makers were in a bit of a hurry writing this rule set and left a little bit of a zone of freedom. And the teams have really gone for it and opened up what they can do on the rear of the floors quite a lot. And they didn't see that coming. They've also cut down the diffuser strakes inside the diffuser, though not unless your car's painted orange, then you found a loophole. And they've reduced the size of the rear brake ducts. And that's nothing to do with brake cooling. There's all these fins around the brake duct that they've cut the size of those lower down. So it's a bit, they expected about a 10% cut in downforce overall, particularly at the rear. But the teams have already recovered, the top teams, this is according to Pirelli, have only now back to 4% loss year on year. And Mario Sola was telling me that he expects the latter half of the season lap records every qualifying session.
These teams are just too clever. Tom, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Because I kind of came into this season thinking, well, you know, nothing's going to change. But yeah, to see Mercedes struggling, it really was a big shock. And one thing that was really noticeable for me was watching the onboards. We did like a testing watch along, and we were like sort of watching it through. And I don't think I've ever seen Lewis Hamilton correct a steering wheel so much on a hot lap. Pretty much, I think he corrected the steering wheel more times on one hot lap than he did probably the whole of last season, because we're so used to the Mercedes just looking like it's on rails, aren't we? And it just sticking at every single corner. And, you know, like a lot of people are questioning whether it's sandbagging, but I mean, at the end of the day, what have they got to gain by beaching it in the gravel? If it was sandbagging, you know, they might just set slower lap times or back off, but that car genuinely looked a handful.
Just talk to them and you can see how big of a situation that is for them, you know. And it will be really interesting to see if they can turn it around one more time, you know. They don't even know where to look at, you know. As Sam said, they think it's an aero issue, but it can also be a tire issue, you know. We all have heard the discussions about what could have been the cause of it, you know, maybe the low rake philosophy of the car, or maybe the front wing philosophy that might have played a role in it, you know. There are maybe several explanations, and they're still digging, you know. They're just digging at it, but you know, we all know how Mercedes works, and they probably turn it around. But it's, for us, it's a nice situation to see them struggling for once, and it can only make the first race of the season more exciting.
And now you talk about rake, so let's go to the high rake cars, the cars that really look kind of almost like they're on hydraulics at the rear end, they're so high up. And that would be Red Bull, namely, the AlphaTauri as well, because it's kind of the design philosophy carries through. But that Red Bull, it looked crazy, Tom, from my point of view, just watching at home, because I also was not allowed to go to testing. It looked like a good car.
Yeah, finally, Red Bull sort of looks like they've got it nailed from the first test. And I think that was the big worry for a lot of people, that you had Verstappen beating the Mercs in the final race in Abu Dhabi, and you went, oh, why now? Why do they always turn up too late? And it looks like now, finally, they might have nailed it. Fingers crossed.
It'd be so exciting if they have. I think Honda have done a pretty good job with the engine as well, Sam. I come to you because you're the man that seems to know quite a lot about what goes on at Honda. So have they done a good job? Can we finally see a Red Bull challenge from the start of a season?
There's a white and blue car, I think, that might get in the muddle, actually.
Really?
The AlphaTauri looks incredibly good. But let's not forget who set the fastest time in testing. It was a little Japanese chap called Yuki Tsunoda. He was flying, and bear in mind, that 20-year-old hadn't raced a car of any sort when Pierre Gasly was a Formula One driver.
What?
Yuki Tsunoda hadn't started his first car race when Pierre Gasly had made his Formula One debut.
That is the best. If anyone's got a better stat than that, lay it on the table now. We're all going home.
Because, and to be honest, looking at the onboards of him driving the car, the AlphaTauri looked pretty competent. It looked like it was quick, clearly. It looked like it was working well. And he was just able to control the switches really just naturally. And that's a lot of simulator time and pounding around Imola in an older car, but still, he looks really exciting. And all the engineers there are like, yeah, he's quick. He's genuinely quick. So there's a lot of excitement around him. Pierre Gasly, proven race winner now. And that car, the AlphaTauri, is essentially last year's Red Bull, or the 2019 Red Bull slightly, but with all the 2020 Red Bull, with all of the handling imbalance ironed out. They didn't go for that gearbox, which we understand had the gearbox casing was creating some sort of either kinematic or compliance issue. We're not quite sure of the reasons for it, but the gearbox was the issue with the handling imbalance that Red Bull had last year. So that's where the suspension mounts. And so AlphaTauri haven't gone for that. They're keeping the 2019 Red Bull gearbox, but they've gone for 2020 Red Bull everything else. And that could be a really potent car at the start of the season. And let's not forget, behind Pierre Gasly and Yuki Tsunoda is exactly the same Honda mill that's powering... I keep on getting the driver line up at Red Bull wrong. Max Verstappen and Sergio Perez. It is the same engine. I think, well, the Red Bull team, everything, all the focus is going to be on there. A little bit of clever strategy. You could see that white and blue car doing some pretty special stuff early on as well.
We talked to Helmut Marko today, and they're not quite ready to accept the role, to be pushed into the favorite role, you know. They said we probably had less fuel in the car than Mercedes, and yeah, they're not quite there yet. But just another funny story on Tsunoda. Helmut Marko today accused us to have ignored Tsunoda for too long because we are German and we were focusing too much in Formula 2 on another German chap, you know, and having ignored his guy. And now we are all surprised by his good performance yesterday in Bahrain. But yeah, it's the lap was very impressive. Even the Mercedes guys told us that, you know, you have to put that time on in the a lap together to get that time, and it can't be a bad car if it's able to get to that lap time. So very impressive.
That's actually last year's monocoque. So those monocoques that was right, the one Tsunoda was running around in was an old one from last year that they'd cut bits out of, glued in the new bits to fit the new front suspension, sealed it up again, and gone out and run it. And that's what they're doing for these cars. They're the old cars that essentially cobbled together is the wrong word, but you know, these are old cars that have been so heavily modified they're not really recognizable. But they didn't even make new monocoques for this, which is really remarkable.
That sounds like what Franz Tost would do. I do believe that, yeah.
Tom, when it comes to the young kids coming through, Tsunoda clearly was very exciting last season as a rookie. Very exciting to have him in Formula One now. And as the guys say, how do you rate him? Because you specialise in the young guns, the debutantes.
I will be and always will be a massive fan of any Japanese driver in Formula One anyway. But Yuki Tsunoda, when he first, you know, I was following him very closely in Formula 2, genuinely thought he was the driver of the year, because a rookie in F2, it's so difficult to get used to those Pirelli tyres. You see a lot of people in Formula 2. You saw Mick, it took him a year to get up to speed, really. Yuki is a rookie. A few unfortunate incidents, and he could have very easily won that title. And I was surprised when, you know, we put a post out there about Yuki Tsunoda joining, and it seemed like a lot of people were just like, oh, well, you know, Honda, that's the only reason he's there. And I was like, no, this guy's something really, really special. And it seems like him in testing has already changed everyone's mind, which is maybe a little bit early, but I think he's going to be really, really impressive. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yuki is certainly, I think, the shortest driver that we've had in Formula One for a while. I haven't done my stats. I can't corroborate that. I can't give you all the checking. But Toby, what problems does it cause for teams when you have a short driver and a tall driver? Because it is difficult.
Yeah, he talked about that in the official FIA press conference, that there were some issues with his pedals, you know, because they always have to mount a new set of pedals for him when they switched cars with Gasly and him, and obviously they had to expand the pedal set. I don't know exactly how it works. Probably Sam can talk us a bit, tell us a bit more about that. But you know, he's 159 meters. I don't know. Well, that's in imperial numbers. I know
why not? Come on, five foot two.
Yeah,
5 foot 2. Oh, okay, yeah, that's.
I googled it really fast, Toby.
Okay, so he's probably the shortest driver I know to come along. So yeah, for the engineers, it's definitely a challenge. But yeah, for him, he's a very light guy, you know. It can only be a good thing, you know, to have such a driver in the car. Also, from an aerodynamic standpoint, the shorter the better.
That's not quite true, Toby. You've got to still see out of the car. So you know, In terms of pedals, I actually have no clue, and that's a really good point. And I'm going to go and ask the team to show us how they do it, and hopefully they'll say yes, and we'll make a little film of it. But I'd really like it to be like when you go arrive and drive karting and there's someone short in the car and you've got those little clips on the pedal and the spring that just flick over when you do the driver change and you're swapping over to someone diddy. And, you know, that I want it to be like that. And, you know, when they swap him over, just pull those little clips forward and get out and, you know, go out and do the next lap.
I always have those clips. And I'm always partnered. If I ever do a partner race, I'm always partnered with someone who's obviously going to be hugely taller than I am, because most people are men and most men are taller than me. So, yeah, feel my pain. Other rookies, how did you think they did? Let's come to you, Tom, again.
The other two rookies, it's difficult, isn't it? Because, I mean, Haas just seem a little bit of a mess, really, to be honest. They're not... See, I know they've obviously got the money coming in and they're hoping that that builds, but I mean, they've already pretty much seemed like they've sacked the year off, certainly not bringing a new car, which I learned from watching one of Sam's videos.
And just to point out, in that video, there was an error because the team had said quite openly that they're not going to develop the car at all anymore. And some bloke called Toby sent me a message and told me some quite interesting stuff.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe they are developing then.
Yeah, they already put a new front wing on and some other stuff in your floor. And yeah, there's a little bit is to come, but even Günther said it's not worth mentioning. You know, it's just little stuff. And over the season, they shift focus very early on the 2022 car.
With two rookies in the car, it is going to be difficult for them to make any progress. But they've always said this is their learning year, this is their building year. They just kind of almost want to gain as much experience as they can out on track and just get them to next year as quickly as they can. It's not about survival for Haas, finally. Sam, is it?
I mean, the whole Haas F1 team was launched as the all-American team designed to sell machine tools around the world. I mean, yeah, Russia's a big place with a lot of industry, but are they buying Haas machine tools? I'm not sure if that's a big seller in Russia. Possibly is, but if Gene Haas has got a bit fed up of doing Formula One and spending lots of money, and the Drive to Survive documentary that we've seen on Netflix sort of suggests at times he's come pretty close to pulling the plug, I just wonder if there's going to be, you know, an insert of rubles from the Marzipan family into that team and take it over.
Now, Samuel, I got very much beaten down from a Haas press conference for asking that question of a certain driver and told that I was looking for a headline. I don't even write headlines. I don't do headlines.
It'd be a red, white and blue headline, Jenny. The patriotic colours of the United States of America.
Probably. Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, definitely an American flag on that car, yeah.
There is an American flag on it. There is still an American flag.
Oh, yeah, it's really small, isn't it, right at the bottom?
Certainly not on the front wings.
You know, they presented the car at 3 a.m. North Carolina time, so I think that says a lot.
Definitely their target audience was met at that moment. Right, let's not talk about Haas too much because we want to go back up the other end. And should we talk McLaren? Because I think out of everybody who came to testing, they were one of the more surprising teams because they came up with something that wasn't expected. Sam, talk about rear ends, talk about diffusers.
McLaren turned up with a car that isn't designed to run the power unit it's got in the back of it. They didn't get any tokens because they had to change the bits of the cars to put the new power unit in. That's why they haven't changed the name of the car. It's I didn't expect much of them. I expected the car to be a bit of a lash up and they'd have to spend all their time and effort trying to get that power unit installed properly. And then they're turning up with some pretty clever aero. And for those who haven't seen it, what they've done is they've found a little dimensional, they say it's not a loophole, it's definitely a loophole, a dimensional loophole in the regulations. But again, the rule makers, when they were coming up with the new diffuser regulations, said, oh yeah, we'll write the rules like this and this is what this means, and had missed a little bit that allowed them to sort of extend a couple of fins along the rear sides of the gearbox cover on the floor of the car, and essentially gave themselves a little bit more strakeage in the diffuser area. And that should, in theory, give them a little bit of a downforce boost. And it's not an easy thing to copy. It looks pretty simple. So get the flow structures, get the air and stuff working underneath the car the way you need it to. That is going to take a lot of teams a long while, particularly if they only first saw it on the first day of testing. That's weeks or even months away from being deployable on other cars.
Toby?
Yeah, James Keed told us yesterday that it's probably the quickest you can do it is 3 to 5 weeks, you know, and that means only bolting, you know, a new floor to the car. If you have to adjust other parts of the car, it will take even longer. But they try to downplay the effect of the solution. You know, it's not a double diffuser that gave Jenson Button the championship in 2009. But you know, we will see. We have to wait. You know, till other teams copy the solution. You can see how much effort they put in copying, how much it's really worth. If they come up with a solution themselves in a couple of weeks or a couple of months, and all do it, it's probably a bigger thing that we think of right now. You know.
I love the fact that Christian Horner, final day of testing, I think after the sessions had finished, he was asked about the diffuser at McLaren. They said, oh, yeah, well, yeah, it was a solution we looked at. Come on, really? I mean, F1, Tom, is all about smoke and mirrors. Surely that, I mean, there are some fairly rich statements coming out from people at this moment in time.
Yeah, a lot of mind games already. Like we were saying earlier, you know, Helmut Marko playing down that Mercedes are quickest, Mercedes saying, no, we're really struggling, Red Bull are quicker. It's always the same, isn't it? And I know one thing I thought was funny about McLaren is I noticed that when they put up their pictures on Twitter, they actually were like covering, I'm sure this is something that Sam and Toby hate, that you know, they'd put a massive Instagram filter over the top of it. So the whole car was pretty much blacked out. And then people had, you know, enhanced it and you could see they'd pretty much just scribbled all over it in Microsoft Paint. So they're obviously pretty happy to hide their parts and didn't want people to know because they were one of the first to launch. But I'm amazed by McLaren because I must admit, I thought a lot of people were hyping them up and I thought, you know, putting a new engine in, I didn't think it would be as spectacularly bad as when they first put the Honda engine in and that was an absolute, you know, they had an awful, awful time. But I didn't expect them to be straight out the blocks and well they seem like they're a lot of people saying that they're you know best of the rest fairly comfortably so we'll see.
I got so much grief for saying that I thought that McLaren could well be either second or third in the championship. I got grief for saying that I thought Ricciardo could frequently get on the podium and possibly win races as well. Hammered for it at the end of
last
year.
I saw that
tweet
and was like no.
The writing's on the wall. If you look at the resurgence of that team, if you look at Andrea Seidel and how much he's been able to do, then you add to that Daniel Ricciardo, then you add to that the fact that they've got a Mercedes engine in there. What could go wrong, Sam?
I mean, I was going to make the point where Tom was talking about the teams putting Microsoft Paint, Photoshop over it, and you were saying we probably hate it. I personally love that because it's a giant neon sign to me saying, look at this bit, it's probably quite interesting. It's if a team wanted to put us off the scent, they should cover up the boring bits because we would go chasing after the bits they're covering up first. It's like putting up the list of priorities. And there are teams who have done that in the past. McLaren, I don't know, testing's a funny thing. You can't read much into the lap times. Yeah, they looked pretty together, but I think there's teams out there that we didn't quite get a good read on, like Ferrari and Aston Martin. I didn't really see those. I don't think we've really seen those teams do what they can. The midfield scrap is looking enormous. Alpine looked really strong at the moment, and I'm not sure how real that is. I'd be surprised if it is, because it's, as I say, it's an old car. Yeah, I still think that was a very brave tweet, Jenny.
By brave, Sam means foolish. Let's talk about the Alpine, because that was a funky old looking car. Tom, making cars beautiful is something that you really like to do. You like to appreciate a beautiful looking car. So the Alpine, beauty or the beast?
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's I was very shocked by it's almost like a 70s Ligier airbox as well, which was massive. But the kind of switch over to Alpine and you've got like the French racing blue. I think it's just a beautiful looking car. And yeah, I mean, Alpine, it's going to be interesting to see how they do with Fernando Alonso coming back, because he's a demanding character, isn't he? And he's going to want he's going to want the best from them. But it just depends where, you know, what they think is going to go with it, because it's just, like you say, the midfield. I've heard so many things of people saying, I can't remember who this quote was from, but he said the midfield is no longer a midfield, it's a field or something, that it's that close. And that's exactly what we want to see. You know, we if you could have said, I think we'd have all taken it, saying that Red Bull and Mercedes seem quite close and then the whole midfield is just anyone's guess. That's what we wanted to see. I think I thought it would be quite predictable, the same as last year, but it doesn't seem like that's the case, which is great.
And even Alfa Romeo, you know, from coming from the back, looks like to have made the step, you know, and joined the other midfield runners. If you talk to the engineers like Jan Monchon, who's by the way speaking very well German, he looks very excited, you know. He's not, you know, it's all of them trying to play stuff down, you know, but you can see it in his face, you know, in his emotions. They're really upbeat, you know. They think they have made a step to be back in the midfield, fighting for points probably.
I think that quote about it's not a midfield, it's a field, I don't want to sound like an archaeologist and digging into this, but there is one team that we haven't mentioned, and I saw a stat just before we started chatting, and I saw a stat that I hadn't picked up on until I was looking into it. Of all the cars and all the lap times we've seen through all 3 days of testing, every single team, bar one, is somewhat slower than their fastest lap at Bahrain in 2020. The team that's faster is Williams. They're 1.1 seconds faster than their best lap on the Bahrain circuit just, well, what seems like a few weeks ago. They've made some comments saying, in the right conditions, our car is really quick, but we know that, and sometimes the conditions aren't right, and we'll struggle. But I think they're going to be one of these teams that suddenly appears, you know, you might see George Russell in particular, suddenly appearing in the top 10 and doing some quite impressive things, but then maybe change to compounded tyres or the wind changes and drops out the back. It could be a really interesting car to watch, that one. I think Williams they've made a huge amount of changes on that car, and I think they are now, at least one of their cars is in the midfield.
Okay, impressive. We haven't spoken too much about Aston Martin, and we haven't spoken too much about Ferrari. In fact, I don't think we've mentioned the F word so far. So, Toby, mention the F word for us. Ferrari. Are Ferrari fans, because I hear that there are a couple of them or whatever, are they going to have a happier season?
It's too early to say, you know. Those testing days, those three testing days are probably the hardest to examine in recent years. We've seen not much from Ferrari in terms of great lap times, you know. We saw at least two race simulations, if I remember correctly. Charles Leclerc did one on Sunday morning, parallel to Kimi Raikkonen, and the cars were both on the track, on the same place, right behind each other on the track, and you couldn't see that Charles was able to gain space on Raikkonen behind him, or Kimi was able to keep up with Leclerc pretty easily, at least it looks like that. So that didn't look very impressive. They say they made gains in terms of straight line speed. The car handles well, the balance is okay. But, you know, Binotto, he didn't look too enthusiastic, you know. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not too optimistic, to be honest, from what I saw. But it's really hard to determine.
Sam?
Just looking at the guys in the paddock and just getting the sort of read off them, chatting to them, they didn't seem like their heads were down. They didn't seem demoralized. They didn't seem like, oh, we're going out and, you know, we're off to a prize fight. But they didn't seem down. They said they felt, you know, they felt moderately content with life, I would say. Something I think I'm really going to be looking to do in qualifying is going to be doing a rate of acceleration test in Sector 1 and Sector 3. So we can look at the data in great detail to see how fast the car accelerates through the gears in those two long traction zones, those two long straights, so the start of the lap, so once they've come out of turn 1, 2, and 3 at Bahrain, then down to the next corner, and then on the way back as they come down that long penultimate straight, you can get a really good measure of how well a car accelerates, and also and then when you get up to the sort of, when they start hitting drag as a wall, get drag limited, you start to see where they are in terms of power as well. I think the Ferrari, well, I'm going to say it. Mika Salo put something out in the Finnish media saying that Ferrari had less gas because they were caught being a bit naughty at the end of 2019. By less gas, I think he means petrol. And by less petrol, I don't think that was the fuel allowance for the race, because that wouldn't affect their qualifying pace or their ultimate single lap pace. I think it was a lower fuel flow limit. And I think they only had about 95 kgh of fuel compared to everybody else on 100. And I think that's now been corrected and they're back at the same level. And just by that token, I think you're going to see Ferrari scrapping for race wins.
Bold. Very bold. Okay. Tom, from your point of view, a lot of fans obviously get in touch with WTF1. What do the fans say about Ferrari? Are they happy, sad? Where are we?
I think last year it definitely seemed a bit of a joke to a lot of people that they've kind of, their demise. It's a bit of a shame, really, to see a team like that fall. You do want to see someone like Ferrari at the front. They're, you know, an historic team, and you want to see as many people at the front as possible. I guess the exciting thing of them sort of dropping out the midfield is the fact that we ended up with so many podium finishes, because anytime the Mercedes and Verstappen had a problem, you know, you had Gasly winning a race or Perez winning a race, and so many different podium finishes. But Ferrari are a strange one, because they've got two fairly youngish drivers, which I feel like you almost kind of forget that a team like Ferrari don't really have. And then I guess it's kind of the same with, it's strange that Verstappen almost feels like he is the team leader at Red Bull, and Leclerc is the team leader at Ferrari, but they're both so young. You're used to team leaders being the Lewis Hamiltons, not these two guys that have not really been in F1 that young and are very young. So those two trying to develop the car, I wouldn't be surprised if those two really push each other, maybe a little too far in places. I'd be amazed if they go through the whole year without a little bit of contact.
Oh, Ferrari back to clashing. Fun times. Aston Martin arguably had one of the more dodgy testings. They had electrical glitches, a gearbox problem, troublesome turbo. It seemed like they never quite got it together in that green car. Toby, do you sense trouble for the team?
And the funny thing is, you know, Sebastian Vettel was waiting so long to drive a Mercedes engine, and now most of his troubles have been sourced in Mercedes parts, you know, in the gearbox and the engine. We don't know exactly the source of the reason behind the turbo issue, but yeah, it cost him a lot of track time, and track time is all he needs right now, you know, getting more comfortable in the cars, and that's what he told us before, and that's what he told us yesterday. He needs the time to get used to all the systems, to all, you know, just to the seating, to get to know how the car reacts, how the car wants to be driven. That's how he phrases it all the time. And I don't expect him to be on 100% for the first, let's say, three or four races. You know, it probably will take a bit of time. Whereas the Martin stands in the pecking order is also quite hard to tell, because the car was not on track a lot, and they didn't do a lot of, you know, push laps or stuff that where you can get a little bit of knowledge where they might stand. You know, it's very hard to read Aston Martin.
Looks nice though, Tom, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I say that. It's one of those, I'm not the biggest fan of British Racing Green, to be honest, because I think it just
stop this call right now. Get out of here.
I know. See, I knew that would be controversial. But yeah, it's one of those cars where, I don't know, it looks a little bit boring on track, maybe. They certainly talked the talk, didn't they, with the launch. They, Lawrence Stroll being there, like, we're going to win, and we had a lot of, when we did our preview, you know, we had a lot of tweets saying like, oh, Aston Martin looked really strong. And you're thinking, we've not seen them on track at all yet. And you're kind of buying into this whole, like, just essentially from a launch that they were there, like, we're this super team now. And a lot of people buying into it. And then probably one of the most disappointing teams from the whole test, really, just the fact that didn't really set a representative quick laps or anything, and seemed to be quite unreliable, and you kind of thought that team would kind of really be aiming for third, especially after last year Racing Point winning at the end of the season and the car being so good and then getting a world champion like Vettel in. But it just doesn't seem to be the case.
You're talking nonsense there, Tommy. British Racing Green is lovely, but that car is not British Racing Green. I've seen it in the carbon. It's quite a light green, and you see that a little bit in the photos. But looking at it on the screen, it could be that the screens I was looking at weren't particularly well adjusted in the light. But to me, it was really hard to tell that car apart from the Mercedes. They both kind of looked a bit black at the front.
And the AlphaTauri as well.
Yeah, exactly. They all looked similar, It was hard to tell them apart. But what I do like is the sort of return to national racing colours. And at risk of sounding a bit like Chris Medland, I think it's a really nice thing to see those cars with the identity. But it would be nice if fewer of them were painted blue. That's the French racing colour. And Alpine are quite right to use it. But everybody else seems to have gone for it. It seems to be blue as the colour for this year. But it's interesting. Just to go back into more of my world, there used to be a time, and I don't know if teams still do this, but there used to be a time that teams would colour match an individual panel, a type of paint, against the television feed to see what it looked like on TV. So when you're at the track, those Marlboro McLarens looked a bit more orange than they did red. But when you looked at them on TV, they, of course, looked that like a flying fag packet. Whereas actually, I think teams may have stopped doing that as much. And there was a time where I remember the Orange Arrows guys were telling me a great story about it. They got a bunch of 1/43rd scale models and just started painting them with Airfix paints to see which looked best before. And that's how they came up with their Orange Arrows livery. It looked pretty good. Now it's all professional graphic designers, corporate. And I really think Formula One needs to have a really big check, because when you're hearing comments like, when I was a boy, I dreamed of being the majority shareholder in Aston Martin, and some of the comments in some of the other teams' press releases, what we really need to avoid as a sport is going down the route of WEC a few years ago and certainly Formula E at the moment, where all of the cars are just corporate branded nonsense and they don't have any beautiful identity. The cars that you do your videos of, you do the retro liveries, they look 10 times better than a lot of the cars at the moment out there. And I think a lot of those teams need to take a step back and go, look, our cars look rubbish. This isn't a corporate spreadsheet presentation. This is a beautiful piece of engineering. You need to paint it to look brilliant. They've forgotten how to do good liveries. And the fact that you're all doing livery analysis on your websites and stuff like that, that's nonsense. Talk about the engineering. They're rubbish.
I know you love that side of it. Yeah, the Aston. It's funny you mentioned that about the Aston, because I remember reading about, I'm sure it was Jaguar in the 2000s, that British Racing Green didn't show up on television. So they painted it pretty much lime green and it looks completely different. That was always a surprise for me when I started going to races for the first time as a kid. It was like, oh, wow. Like you say, the Marlboro Ferrari looks like fluorescent orange or something. And then when you see it on TV, it's red. So, yeah. The Aston, they've not got something quite right there, because like you say, it just looks like the color wise anyway, the Mercedes a lot of the time.
Looks great on the radio.
It's funny, we had a video call with a Aston Martin designer who's normally responsible for designing road cars, and he told us the design process of the livery took them 12 months, and they thought it's spectacular. And when it came out, you know, it's green with a little pink, pink accent bit, yeah. So I don't know what they did in that 12 months.
Right, we're running out of time, but Toby, from your point of view, you have some fascinating information that you can share with us about testing, and I think one of the key things that we all know is that testing is all about secrets. It's all about keeping your cards close to your chest. I won't say sandbagging, but what do you guys do as a publication to try and get to the bottom of the secrets?
This year was a bit special, unfortunately. But normally, you know, when we have access to the paddock and the pit lane, we put a lot of effort to get really to the bottom of it and get really good pictures, of course, trying to get the little secrets, you know, that the engineers want to hide. And when we started covering the tests, we tried to ask our photographers or Formula One photographers to take pictures of those, you know, little things, and they declined because they are Formula One photographers and they want to get want to take pictures of other stuff, you know, PR stuff from the teams, and they're not allowed if they do take those secret stuff. So we ask a spy photographer who's taking pictures of prototype cars, prototype road cars. Normally he's hiding in the woods in northern Finland in the winter, you know, to something like that. And he has no association with Formula One normally. So we took him to the pit lane, and he knows how to take pictures, you know, when people are in front of him and stuff like that. So we take him there, and we can tell him, you know, where to put the lens on, where to put the camera, because we get the access from the engineers. They tell us what's new on their cars, what they see on other cars, you know, and yeah, that helps us a lot. And I got a lot of people, you know, on the internet, on Twitter, and so they tell that they see something on the cars, and they ask me to take a picture from a special area, you know, and then we get those good exclusive stuff. But this year was unfortunately a bit different, you know, with restricted access in Bahrain.
You know, as soon as I saw that Hamilton spin, and he was beached, I was like, oh, Mercedes are going to hate this because they're going to have to lift the car. Everyone's going to see the floor. And what's the one thing Mercedes didn't want to happen? They didn't want the car to get beached so that it had to be lifted. But they've got different tarps now, Sam. They've got like wraparounds that go under and over and like fasten at the side. That is cheeky.
It doesn't matter, though. The photographer's out on track. I've got some lovely pictures of the Mercedes diffuser from before that and after that. But you, as soon as the car leaves the pit lane and it's driving around, these photographers know what they're doing. And I know the photographers that Amos use in their magazine, because I've used some of the same ones, and they are excellent. And yeah, we've seen a lot. The advantage I have now is that working with F1, I've got access to all of the camera feeds from the pit lane. And there's also a couple of additional camera feeds which aren't ever sent to broadcasters unless we've made a package of it. And these are the ones that are just focusing on the technical aspects of the car. And because it's Formula One, the teams can't really get in front, though they do sometimes. You know, the cameramen I'll just sort of say, oh, there's an interesting bit I've seen there. And I've seen a tweet or I've seen one of Toby's posts. And I go, can we get down to Red Bull and get a look at this bit, please? And the cameraman wobbles down there, films the bit, and then we get the footage. And that's where those little bits you see on the broadcast come from, of those little bits of the car. So all we're doing is I'm staring at photographs of the car from the photographers, watching the feeds, and then there's a few of us sitting there just going, oh, that's an interesting bit. But we're also reading everybody's tweets. We're looking at like the F1 technical forum. It's a real different world to the way it was maybe even 5 or 6 years ago, where it was just a few of us technical journalists looking at the cars. Now you've got tens of thousands, maybe even millions of people staring at the cars, looking for those little details. So it's almost impossible for a team to keep anything hidden for any amount of time.
Don't try.
Just one question, Sam. Do you have also access to those ceiling cameras that they use for Parc Fermé surveillance inside the garage? Because
if I did, I couldn't tell you, yes.
So they are probably pretty interesting because they're right above the cars, you know.
Those go to the FIA, yeah. But there are some shared feeds, and there's some channels that I'm not allowed to look at, but we do get data off the cars where I work, and I do get to look at stuff, some of the data channels. So that's quite interesting, and that's where we get some of the graphs from. So when you're seeing the cars going around the track, you're seeing that little graphic on the screen with the RPM, the brake pressure, the steering angle. I've got all the raw data from that, and so we can save that out. And some of the stuff that, if you're on, you're in Germany, unfortunately, Toby, so you're not going to be able to get this. But in those countries that can get the pit lane channel, there's going to be some really special stuff on that this year. And I think some of that data, I think there's going to be some teams who aren't going to be, you know, I think the teams are look at, they know they've got the data. I think we're going to be using it in ways that might highlight things a little bit much for their liking, but it's going to be fun for the fans.
Okay, let's wrap things up by just doing a quick speed round. Okay, so I want the first thing that comes into your mind. Don't deliberate, don't justify, just give me an answer. Okay, so we're going to go in an order. It's always going to be Sam, Toby, Tom. Best livery?
Alpine.
Alpine.
Alpine, easy.
Worst livery?
The Russian car.
I have to say the Russian car, yeah.
Williams.
Oof, ouch. Who had the best test?
AlphaTauri.
Red Bull.
Red Bull.
Who had the worst test?
Mercedes.
Aston Martin.
Aston Martin.
Who had the best innovation?
McLaren.
Yeah, McLaren.
McLaren, yeah.
The most exciting prospect?
Yuki Tsunoda.
I have to agree, even if we are the land of Mick Schumacher.
Same, yeah, same. Yuki.
Okay, it's going to get hard. Best race. What do you think is going to be the best race?
Oh, they're going to be the best race. Monza.
Interlagos.
Silverstone.
Okay. And final two, I'll ask the driver's champion first, Sam.
Lewis Hamilton.
Unfortunately, Lewis Hamilton. Not because I don't like him, but it's getting boring.
Yeah, same, Hamilton.
And team championship.
Mercedes.
Yep.
Mercedes.
Come on, where is the hope? Where is the hope? I thought one of you would say Red Bull.
We'd love to be wrong, I guess. We all love to be wrong.
Maybe at the start. I just can't see it, can you? It's been... They're just too good. Simple as that.
Right, our time is up. Thank you so much. Thank you to Tom, to Toby, to Sam. I wish you all a very good start of this season. Let's keep in touch. And to everybody at home, thank you so much for watching. We hope you've enjoyed it, this special testing session. And game on for the start of the season.
Thanks for listening. Remember, if you've enjoyed it, then subscribe and keep yourself up to date with Fast Talkers.